So let's plunge in and try to make a dent on this pile. Again, I'm only going to read those excerpts of the question that I think will be of general interest, not the whole essay that precedes it. Suppose a statistical study were to show that some phenomenon has a 90% relationship to the existence of some prior circumstance. What is the epistemological status of this relationship? Isn't it reasonable to assume that some aspect of the causal link has been discovered? No, not necessarily. If you get a correlation between two phenomena on the 90% range, you cannot per se, from that sheer fact, assume any causal relation. It entirely depends on the context, on the knowledge you have of those two phenomena, of their nature, of the laws you have that it might be relevant. It has been said that within a certain range there was a 100% concomitant variation between the degree of famine in one province of India for a period, I believe, of several years, and the number of semicolons in the editorial page of the New York Times. And they went up and down together across a period of several years. Now, if you take a short enough time frame, and you are ingenious enough in selecting your factors, you can establish high correlations between virtually anything. So what you have to do is know, do you have any reason from your prior knowledge and from the nature of the entities to suspect a relationship? Does it make sense given the nature of the entities? What do you know about them? And then, the most you can say is, if the context makes it plausible, not that you have found a causal relationship, but that you have found something that is worth investigating further. Probabilities and statistical correlations are not knowledge. They are simply the beginning of knowledge. They are the stage of the raw observation which says, in effect, look in this direction rather than in that. But the very fact that it's 90% means you do not have a causal relationship, because cause necessitates effect 100% of the time. So what you have to do in a case like that at minimum is, what is the hidden variable that is present in some cases and not in others? Until you find that, until you convert it to something which is 100% and which you can also say not only that it happens, but at least one level of knowledge as to why. What is it in the nature of the entity that would lead to this? Until you have that, you can't say a causal connection. Now, a question that I threw out by accident and remembered coming here, so I wrote it down, I rewrote it as best I could, and it was, why don't animals have rights? Why should human lives be regarded as more important than animals? That was the approximate wording, and I remembered coming here that I didn't bring the piece of paper that had that. There are piles all over the apartment, and I missed that pile. Why should human life be regarded as more important than animals, than animal life? And there's one big question that you have to answer to that question. More important to whom? Now, this questioner is asking this of me as a human being. And I am very proudly prejudiced, if you want to call it that. I am an egoist about the species as well as the individual. I certainly place my life and the species which I subscribe to far above that of any other. And if it comes to a conflict, and in this case it unavoidably comes to a conflict, it's my species, that was to say my life and what it requires, above theirs. Now, I give animals the same prerogative. If a group of mosquitoes or monkeys want to get together and say, we're more important than you are, say, absolutely right. And if you can enforce it, good luck to you. Now, the real answer, though, that they cannot do this, they cannot intercommunicate, they can't decide on principles and so on, because they don't have the faculty of reason, and that is the deeper answer. Rights are coextensive with the faculty of reason. To respect someone's rights means to treat him by persuasion rather than by coercion. It means to say he is a sovereign entity and you will appeal to his mind. If he doesn't have a mind, it's out of the question. You cannot, if a raging lion is coming at you, say, let's sit down and discuss this. You shoot him before he eats you, and that's it. Otherwise, you get eaten. That is exactly the situation which makes rights out of the question, inapplicable and impossible. You first have to have an entity with a rational faculty. Then and then alone do you have rights. Does it mean, therefore, it's morally proper to do anything you want to animals? No. I would say if you wantonly engage in sadistic torture of animals for the sheer pleasure of their suffering, that has nothing, no benefit of medical knowledge or of food or hides or anything like that, no practical, tangible, objective human life benefit, then that is immoral. You should not do that. You're sick, but it's still outside the province of the government to prevent. The government is an agency to protect individual rights, and that's, therefore animals are outside the province of the government. Now, we can jump to patents and copyrights. I'll try to be briefer, because I'm only going to get through four questions at this rate. I'll try to violate my educational principle and give a quick survey answer instead of a depth answer. Apropos of patents and copyrights, this person asks, what about photocopying articles or books for research purposes instead of purchasing the entire work? How do you justify libraries who let people read the book for free? How do you justify used bookstores that resell the author's books? Aren't all those things in violation of the principle of copyright? My answer is it entirely depends on the conditions of the original sale. In a proper society, the author and the publisher could agree among themselves to prohibit all of those things. They could have a thing on the front of the book saying, sale to libraries is hereby prohibited. Xerox is prohibited. Resale in used bookstores is prohibited. Do not buy unless you're going to live up to these particular conditions. And then there would presumably have to be some appropriate enforcing mechanism. In fact, this is not done today for a very obvious reason, although the author would have the right to do it if he wanted to, and if he could get a publisher to publish him under those conditions. It's not done today because it's normally assumed that libraries at least are a tremendous asset to an author. They buy a tremendous number of books, relatively speaking, and their customers are prolific readers who frequently buy the books that they like, and the author is counting on the fact that if they customer gets the book to read it free from the library, he'll then go out and buy it. And so most authors would say, let the libraries and the used bookstores grab my books. The more people that get to read them, the more I'll benefit in the long run. That is, however, a prudential calculation, I would say, that depends on the judgment of the author. As to Xerox, there, I think, there is a real conflict in many cases because the individual is not reading the book and so on. He's stealing part of the book. He's like doing his own little publishing version of part of the book. And I think there is very often a conflict between the interest of the author and that it's not proper to do it. My own attitude toward that is this. I get asked all the time for permission to reprint Xerox Ayn Rand's books or passages from them for different people. And I go always by the principle of self-interest in the long run. In other words, if somebody I think is just trying to rip off the printed edition, I say no. But if, for instance, if as we've had requests for 600 copies of an essay of hers on government for an introductory course at Harvard, on the principles of justice, and we've had that within the last several months, I say yes. And in fact, I even fought with the publisher not even to charge them a nominal fee for that, because my idea is in the long run, we'll sell more copies of her works if we give away 600 copies to Harvard undergraduates than if we charge them for it. So that's, you have to decide what it is, your priorities. But it's not a violation of copyright. Only if it's done against the author's decision. All right, let me go on. Here's an interesting question. An intrinsicist would teach factual knowledge, you said, in no particular order and wouldn't teach thinking methods. However, a rationalist would teach thinking methods and would be concerned with order, for example, Plato. And yet rationalism rests on intrinsicism. And yet, if taken separately, they seem to lead to different educational philosophies. Would you please comment? That's a really good question. My answer to this would be this. I was talking in the lectures about what we can call a pure intrinsicist. And that would be really the religious type, not what we know of as Platonism or the rationalist type. That is, the model of knowledge is revelation. You just wait there and God speaks to you. That is the method that, the approach that does not offer structure or order or thinking methods. A rationalist, in the traditional philosophic sense, is like a better form of intrinsicism. And usually, if you take Plato as the example, what they do is they do teach structure, and the way they inject it into the equation is they make the structure part of reality. They think reality itself is structured and operates on you in stages, like Plato, you know, where the particulars operate on you first and then the lower universals and then only the highest universal at the very end. So he does teach a certain order to thinking. I think what it really amounts to is this. He took the concept of order or logic, structure, and projected it out into reality. He took an element from an objective method and made it metaphysical rather than epistemological. But nevertheless, he did do it. I would also say with regard to Plato and those who follow him, he is more than a Platonist. Plato was also a Greek, and he had a lot of better elements that weren't, he wasn't a pure intrinsicist. Nevertheless, that is certainly an interesting question. Now, here is a tricky question. Two qualities may be mutually exclusive. For example, same and different. I just want to inject right here, those are not qualities. Same and different is not like red and blue. They are relationships. They are the connection between one thing and another. In any event, leaving that point aside, he says, two qualities may be mutually exclusive. For example, same and different, but neither seems to be the positive or the negative. Does the onus of proof rule apply to such concepts? He's thinking of the rule that the onus of proof is on he who asserts the positive. And so the idea would be, if you had two unknown planets, let us say, and someone says they are the same as each other, and someone says, no, they're not the same, they're different, who has the onus of proof? See, is one of those the positive and the other the negative? And then he has a long dissertation here on, well, medium dissertation on, he thinks difference is really, I think he thinks difference is positive and similarity is negative, or whichever, and then is that true? No, it isn't true. My answer would be the onus of proof rule does not apply in a case like that. Difference is not a negative and sameness is not a positive. In the relevant sense here, both of these are positive, even though they are mutually exclusive, because they are both primary perceptual data. There is no way of reducing one to the other. I do not believe that difference is a primary and sameness is a derivative, or vice versa. The only difference between difference and sameness is the number of units required to establish it. Difference you can establish on any two things. Whatever two things you look at, they're different. It's this and this. Sameness or similarity requires three. It requires these two hands, for instance, as against this head, and then they're the same in relation to this. But nevertheless, the fact of being the same is not something you can analyze, nor do you make it any clearer by saying it's not different. The same is simply a direct perceptual relationship, and you can get it the same way you get difference. They are exactly, in that sense, on the same level. And therefore, if you want to establish that something is the same, or you want to establish that it's different, that is, in this context, a positive fact which has to be evidentially supported. The principle of the onus of proof does not apply to relationships like this. That's why it's important that you don't call it qualities. These are relationships. The principle of the onus of proof applies primarily to entities like God and gremlins, etc. Not only, but primarily. It's to entities and that which derives from them. And it's when you have a situation like this. Someone claims this thing exists, and someone says, no, it doesn't. Not that something else exists, not some other type of relationship, but simply no. Now, similarity is not simply no difference. If there was a total vacuum, you would have no difference and no similarity either. You'd have zero. You see what I mean? The onus of proof applies only when it's an entity versus a zero. And in that case, if there's absolutely no evidence for the entity, you say it doesn't exist. Does that answer you, Rick? I shouldn't have asked you.
The only other question is, when one is kind of open-ended, I mean, you can keep measuring and measuring, and they're all the same, but you just need one to find a difference.
Well, you need as many to find a difference as the extent of the difference that you want. How many differences do you want? It's just as much as how many similarities do you want. So it's not fair to say that there's a difference because you're only looking for one difference in 12 aspects in which they're similar. If you define it exactly, I don't think you'll see that there's a difference in that. Now let me get this one out of the way, which was asked about four times. Ayn Rand wrote an article expressing her disapproval of women who aspire to the presidency of the United States. Is this view an essential part of objectivism? I am very confident in saying that if Ayn Rand had voted for president in a contest between Margaret Thatcher and Jimmy Carter, she would certainly have voted for Margaret Thatcher for president of the United States. There is no question that she did not consider it wrong. She was talking from one specific aspect only, symbolically. Symbolically, she thought the president of the United States is the position of leadership of the supreme commander of the military, and given her view of masculinity and femininity, she thought it was much more appropriate that it be a man than that it be a woman. This goes back to her view of masculinity and femininity. The idea, as you know, being masculinity for her was the strong, and femininity was the hero worship, looking up to the strong. Now this, let me say right away, this whole differentiation of masculinity and femininity is not a philosophic issue. It is not part of any system of philosophy. At most, it's part of a system of psychology, in which you could argue in what way anatomical differences, because that's all we have to go on here, anatomical differences have certain psychological effects in the sexual relationships and in the way the two sexes look at each other. But that would require a whole complex theory of psychology. It is absolutely not establishable by philosophic means, and it is not part of objectivism, although it is certainly part of Ayn Rand's approach to characterization in her novels. Now, I know that she personally was consistent in her own feeling in life with her attitude on the woman presidency, because she did not like her own position in the world as the head of a whole philosophic movement. She would have been ecstatic if there was an Aristotle that she could look up to and follow in her time. She thought Joan of Arc had the most tragic life, because Joan of Arc was the symbol of a great woman rallying the men around her, and she thought no woman would want to be in this position. Is this objectivism? No, this is not objectivism. Objectivism is determined by principles, not by symbols. You do not have to agree with this symbolic interpretation, even if it's correct, because this is not part of a philosophy. A philosophy is determined by principles. If you reject reason or egoism or capitalism or you believe in God, that's not objectivism. But this does not apply, so I am not going to excommunicate anybody. If you want to run for president, I'll even vote for you. I would like to know, where do you draw the line in deciding in dealing in business with dishonest customers? For example, would you do business with the corrupt government of a Latin American country? If necessary, I would. Because government in this country is corrupt? Absolutely, too. I would draw the line at dealing with totalitarian countries, because there you are dealing with potential threats to the United States and to your own well-being. But if you are in, ideally, you would be in the kind of business that gets you as far away as possible from all corrupt governments, Latin or otherwise. But unfortunately, governments have such a tremendous stranglehold on business today, at home and abroad, that it's virtually impossible to do it. So assuming you minimize, you have no choice. You have no alternative. I would say don't do anything that expands the power of the bad government, and don't do them one better in the corruption, because you're simply going to be caught. But if you have to obey the edicts of a corrupt government in order to survive, I mean, if they didn't, we couldn't have an industrial world, and I don't know how long we're going to have one anyway. Now it goes on, would you act as an honest agent for a company that you know has dishonest practices? It depends who they're cheating, the government or their customers. I myself would not work if I had a choice. And I do think we still have enough of a choice in that regard for a company that deliberately cheats its customers, even if I myself could be honest in my own function. But I would want to know what really does their dishonesty consist of. If it simply is that they don't live up to every single government regulation and they hedge on them, that is not dishonesty, because no one could survive. But if it really is a con man operation, then I would not think, and I knew it, and I had a choice to survive by another means, I would never say, well, my integrity is fine because I'm very honestly filling out the forms of who we destroy. Oh, now here's some more on romance. If one has been unable to find a serious long-term romantic partner, is it acceptable to seek various aspects of the value derivable from an ideal relationship, i.e. intellectual stimulation, companionship, compatible personalities, common recreational interests, physical attraction, and interaction from more than one person? Given that it may be optimal to find all this in one partner, is it not better to obtain it from several people than not at all? Well, if this question merely means, is it okay to have a lot of friends at the same time? Absolutely. I don't see anything wrong with going to the movies with one woman and playing chess with another and so on. But it seems to suggest a variety of lovers. You go with Miss Smith to the movies and then to bed and so on with Miss Brown someplace else, and you get some one aspect of human companionship from each. I do not think that is valid. Because I indicated an earlier question, romantic love is a very specific kind of response. It is not the appropriate response for everyone in whom you find some authentic value. You have to have a very definite constellation of values, not simply one good feature. I mean, my grandmother has a good feature, but that doesn't make it. Either the partner merits a romantic relationship, or she or he do not. You can't say, well, they got this good feature, so let's spread it around. I mean, you could just as well do that, instead of romance, with sex, and say, well, ideally, you'd want to have a full sexual relationship with one person, but since I can't, I'm going to have foreplay with this woman, orgasm with this one. I mean, even the division of labor has limits. Could you differentiate between the objectivist principle that any compromise between good and evil is immoral, and the Greek emphasis on sophrosyne, or moderation, such as Aristotle's virtue of the golden mean. Yes, the golden mean was never intended by Aristotle as a defense of compromise between good and evil at all. The golden mean was simply a faulty identification on his and the general Greek part of a perfectly valid approach. If you look at Aristotle's trinity of virtues, you know, the extreme in one direction, the extreme in the other, and then the so-called mean in the middle, the mean is not a mean, in fact, at all. It is an opposite principle from the two extremes. So, for instance, you take a braggart on the one hand who says always how wonderful he is, and an excessively humble guy who says how awful he is, and then in the middle, a man who has self-confidence. Aristotle says the guy, the self-confident one, is in the middle. Well, actually, he's not in the middle at all. Both the extremes have self-doubt. It's just two variations of it, as against the man who has self-confidence. So it's just simply a failure to identify the principle involved. It is certainly not that the Greeks or Aristotle advocated compromise as an end in itself. Christianity started the advocacy of compromise in the West for a very simple reason. It was impossible by their own recognition to practice their virtues. But the Greek virtues were based on this world and this life, and you could practice them. They would never have the idea that you shouldn't do what's right, because what was right was to your interest. It was only when you have an impossible code of values that you have to preach, do it sometimes, because the rest of the time you have to live. I think, if you don't mind, I'm going to go on with some more of these written ones, because we're not getting anywhere on this. I didn't give you much choice there, but. Is it immoral of an American to choose to compete against athletes or musicians or chess players from the USSR and other communist societies? No, I would say it isn't, given the state of our government today. As a private citizen, you cannot make foreign policy. If we have a foreign policy which pits us in the sports competitions and all these other things, I don't think you can expect of the individual athlete or whatever not to do it. I don't regard the people who took part in the Olympics as immoral. They are simply on the premise that you don't expect athletes to make foreign policy. They assume that this is somehow fostering America, improving our image, showing that the West is superior. They're doing it for patriotic motives, ill-advisedly. But you don't start by passing moral judgment on people who are in no position to know and who spend their whole time swimming or whatever, while the people in charge are busy selling the country down the river. First, you establish the right foreign policy. And then, if a guy on his own wants to capitulate to a totalitarian country, you say that's immoral of him. But the way things stand right now, the immorality begins in the White House and in selling nuclear technology to Red China. And until that is denounced as the abomination it is, it's too early to ask a football player not to play against Russia. That's my view on that question. What is the objectivist definition of happiness? That's a big jump. The emotion that proceeds from the achievement of a code of non-contradictory values. I'm giving you time to take that down. Happiness is an emotion that comes from achieving values. Not just an individual value, but a whole set of values. It implies a whole basic attitude toward life, a whole basic enduring feeling, as against pleasure, which is a momentary or more superficial thing. And why do I put non-contradictory? Because the whole idea of happiness is and a feeling that is not undercut, that there's no penalty at the time or later, like not the joy of being drunk and then feeling rotten the next day, not the joy of sucking up to somebody hypocritically and then feeling guilty the next day, but non-contradictory joy was Ayn Rand's formulation for it, so that on all fronts, when you achieve your values, it's a completely positive experience. That's a brief statement. Should there be a legal adult age for drinking, the military, voting, anything? Sure. There should be an adult age for voting. You couldn't let three-year-old kids vote, or 10-year-old, in the same. There's a certain minimum age to get in the military. And I can certainly see there should be a legal age for drinking. Since if I have a child, I certainly do not want that child to have the prerogative to go into a store and purchase a bottle of rye at 6 and go home and drink it. Certainly a parent has a perfect right to say, my child cannot be given this. If he wants to do it at home, that's one thing. But you have the prerogative on how to bring up your children. They do not have the right of free trade until they pay for it, until they reach adulthood. So certainly, in the appropriate context, there is such a thing as the legal age, the age at which a government will recognize contracts and hold you responsible. How do you define it is the next question. Within a certain range, it's optional. Anywhere from 18 to 21, I would say, is reasonable. It makes no difference what it is. How long are parents legally responsible for their children? Until that age. Ayn Rand's definition of value specifies acting, that which one acts to gain and keep is of value. What do you call something that a person wants to gain or keep, but for some reason does not act to gain or keep? If you want something and are waiting for the right time to act, is this thing not of value until the person takes action? Well, there's a confusion in that question. It all depends on the reason that the person doesn't act. If it's as it says here, he's simply waiting, the conditions are not appropriate, he can't get a job, or he's in a dictatorship and he's trying to escape or whatever, certainly it's still of value. That which one acts to gain and keep obviously implies in the appropriate context. And something may be a real value and simply the situation is not ripe to act. But this much is true. In one of the very, very early versions of Galt's speech, way before publication, she had that which one, that which one desires or that which one wishes to gain and keep or something like that. And then she, I remember her saying she changed it to acts because she wanted to counteract the implication that you could simply yearn for something all your life long, independent of any action regarded as a value. If there is no specifiable context in which you would do anything, for instance, I want to be a great actor, but I just sit home and want it. I never study acting, I never apply for a job, I never read a play, I never do a thing. Or I want a great romance, but I don't even go so far as to put an ad in New York Magazine, I just sit home and watch TV. Then it's not of value. Then it is truly not of value, it's a self-deception. What I would call it is a self-deception, or a neurotic emotion. But it doesn't mean, therefore, you have to act at every moment for every value. It depends on the circumstances. I thought it would be interesting to give a whole course of what formulations were changed for what reasons, you know. However, not now. I think I'll have to pass this because we're running out of time. And this. Do you believe Immanuel Kant was aware that his philosophy was evil? If so, is he not a real-life example of the seemingly impossible character Ellsworth Tui? I would essentially say yes to both of those questions. In some form, I believe he had to know, because I cannot bring myself to believe that this extensive and profound a corruption was an honest mistake. I can't believe, since honesty is a commitment to reality, that someone could annihilate or think he did the total of reality honestly. I mean, it's a self-contradiction on its face. So I believe in many ways he must have known that this was depravity. And in that sense, I do think he is the closest actual example to Ellsworth Tui in all of history. He looks like him. For one thing, he has the same physique, he had the same delicate health, where he enjoyed ill health all his life. He had the same kind of dynamic lecturing voice. He was really, I don't know that she drew him. I don't think she, Ayn Rand knew Kant at the time, knew his biographical details at the time, but she certainly was fascinated to read them after, long after The Fountainhead, and was struck by the tremendous similarities. Ellsworth Tui is almost an impossible character because he is so conscious of what he's doing, whereas the ordinary villain like Jim Taggart spends most of the time evading, but Ellsworth Tui seems to know it all. Now, actually, he is evading, on many levels also, but he is much more conscious, you see, and that's what makes him virtually fictional. Only I think Kant is the one example that I know in real life of that, or at least the clearest example. Do you believe that Ayn Rand's ideas could only have arisen after the American and industrial revolutions had been attacked? Now, I was going to say yes until the last three words. I don't think that her ideas could have arisen until after the Industrial Revolution, certainly. Because she was the first one to say that prior to the Industrial Revolution, men had no way to know that thought was an instrument of survival. Aristotle, for instance, who was a perfectly honest and brilliant man, thought that everything that was to be learned was already known, that all the practical arts had already been discovered, that they required no thought, and that they were the proper work of menial labor, of slaves, to free the intelligent thinkers for contemplation as an end in itself. And that view lasted all the way until the Industrial Revolution, when it was suddenly discovered that thought actually radically transformed the conditions of existence and was therefore man's means of survival. Or at least that was implicit in the discoveries, but was not known. And that was the fact that she had to get from history itself before she could come up with her theory. So long as thought is not a means to action, in the fundamental sense of the mechanism of survival, then the whole foundation of her approach to ethics is not there. So she often said that she could not have been what, she couldn't have come up with her ideas prior to the Industrial Revolution, but not prior to that they were attacked. The attack didn't help her to come up with it. Why are American schools so much worse than the schools in other countries, given that America had a better philosophic base to start with? Well, I think there's two reasons I could mention. One is a virtue of Americans is that they have a contempt for bad ideas. But the country was to some extent founded on the dichotomy of ideas versus practicality. They, to some extent, threw the baby out with the bathwater. They were fed up with all the philosophizing and junk that they heard, and they just said, get rid of it, let us be practical and focus on, you know, what works in life. And so they did not have the European reverence for intellectual development in the way the Europeans did. Now, the Europeans had their own dreadful other side of that dichotomy, which was knowledge as an end in itself, which of course ripened them to be taken over by every kind of rationalism and intrinsicism and mysticism, and in fact that side led the Europe to its downfall. So you can't have one without the other, mind without body. But I think American education never developed properly because there was never a proper philosophic foundation in this country. And I think, practically speaking, given that setup, that is why the country was so ripe for John Dewey. Because he appealed and said, we are going to educate children for practical life, for real things, for that which works. And of course, in doing it, he put the seal of destruction on what was before just simply a broad tendency. He, in effect, wiped out the mind on principle as a conscious theory. And since that time, he has never been able to appeal around the world the way he did in the United States, for the kind of reason that I indicated. Because people did not know what Dewey's theories really meant, but nevertheless, those theories really did mean that and led to the consequences they unavoidably had to. So I think America, in a way, was done in by the combination of a virtue and the lack of a philosophy to implement that virtue. I've already answered that. I'm trying to wind up and get to the part two. Since what we value as ideas and words are merely symbols for them, can there be a time when a word has been so corrupted that it might be useful to abandon the word and replace it so that people would focus on the ideas instead of the myths that the word has evoked? For example, shouldn't we get rid of the word capitalism and selfishness? Now, I get this question all the time. If only it were so simple. If only you could say, okay, look, selfishness has a bad name. So I'm going to call it a gloopism. I'm going to change Ayn Rand's words to the virtue of gloopism. I swear by my gloop and my love and so on. As one of two things would happen. Either no one would know what I was talking about, so I end up with zero. Or they would know. And pretty soon the idea would come, you know what he means? He means selfishness. Because the reason all these things have grown up has nothing to do with the word, it has to do with the dominant ideas. The people that attach those negative connotations do so because they hate the idea of selfishness or of capitalism. And you're not going to put it over on them by giving them a different word. If they have the least glimmer of what you're talking about, they will quickly attach their new connotations, the old connotations, to the new word. You cannot save the world by speaking a different language. They hate it as much in French as in English. You have to fight the ideas underlying it. And the best way is to take the worst word, if it has a modicum left of meaning, and say, yes, I am a reactionary, I'm a McCarthyite, I'm a pro-selfishness, I'm pro-capitalist, you name it. And then, at least, you get some audience, and then you try to tell them what you mean. At least, you see, you disown the implications of appeasement by doing that. I'm a doctoral student in management at a private university which is dominated by left-wing professors. How can I survive? Should I voice my opinions or keep a low profile? I do not think a college student is morally obligated to voice his opinions if he knows he's going to be penalized for it. I don't think you should be a martyr. If you have reason to believe that you will not be penalized, certainly voice your views as and when appropriate. Sometimes it actually helps you. I found, for instance, that I spoke in college very loudly for my views at the beginning and got thoroughly known, so known that the professors didn't dare give me low grades because they didn't want to be accused of bias. And therefore, I sailed through with high grades, sometimes undeserved, simply because they were standing on their head to prove how fair they were. But this is not always work this way. You have to judge honestly. You don't have to lie about your views, but there's no reason if you're trapped in that situation. Doesn't make any difference if it's private or public. The whole educational system is governmental in its essence. And in a free country, you would never have to go through a doctoral degree. So the fact that you're in it, you're already under force. So it's self-preservation. In your disclaimer at the beginning of your first lecture, you said Ayn Rand has not reviewed all of what you would present, and also reminded us of your fallibility. Do you mean to imply that she was infallible? No. But some people think so. So I was putting them on notice that if they think she is, they surely don't think I am. No, she was not infallible. Nobody is infallible. Did I mean to imply that objectivism is, as she defined it, right or wrong? Now you think about that question. Is objectivism, as she defined it, right or wrong? Absolutely. Objectivism is the name of her philosophy. So if you think it's right or wrong, it's exactly what she said it was. If you have a different philosophy, you call it gloopism or whatever you want, and then that's your philosophy, right or wrong. Now, the thing that this questioner fails to grasp is that a philosophy is not an eclectic congeries of ideas. It is not like four ideas on reality and six ideas on knowledge and three on ethics and like eight or nine on politics. And you know, you could be right on A3 but not B4 and C7. That is not a philosophy. From what we've already said just about integration, you should know that a proper philosophy is one totality. And it's an issue of the basic principles and their consequences. So it's either all right or it's all wrong if it's an integrated system. And therefore, depending on your viewpoint, either objectivism is all right or it's all wrong. But either way, it is what she defined it as, one consistent whole. I view, and then he goes on, I view you and others as having the duty well, let's say, you don't mean that in the strong sense, of adding to and, if necessary, correcting the existing ideas of objectivism. Do you agree? Well, I agree that anybody interested in it who is a professional and philosopher and so on, that's his field, should, if he can, it'd be nice to come up with something more than just reiterating what was already stated. Sure, but nobody has a duty to discover something new. You can't have a duty to discover the new. It's the same reason as why you can't teach how to discover the new. You either do it or you don't. Now, what about, do we have a duty of correcting the existing ideas? If anything is wrong anywhere, anybody who is interested in the truth should correct it. Does that mean I concede that maybe there is an essential principle of objectivism that is wrong? No, because by my understanding, for the reason I just told you, it's one totality. So if any one principle is wrong, the whole thing is collapsed. So in which case, it doesn't make any sense to correct it. You then should start with Hegel or Marx or whoever you can find and do what you can within that framework. Can you say anything? The problem is, you see, that people that ask these questions don't distinguish a principle from a concrete application. They undoubtedly have in mind, if I disagree about a woman president, shouldn't I correct objectivism? That is not objectivism. Someday we'll have to have a whole course on what is a principle, and that will clarify these questions. Because there is really, some things are important, but that doesn't mean they're a principle. Can you say anything about future advances in objectivism as to their direction and subject matter? Yes, I see objectivism as moving in two directions in terms of new material. But obviously, don't ask me to give you this material because it isn't here yet. I think the most pregnant theoretical direction is the one Ayn Rand indicated in her final years, the integration of mathematics and conceptualization. That's what the track she was working on, of which Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology was merely the first indication. She frequently said that the parallels between concept formation and mathematics that she indicated in that book were just to scratch the surface, and that she had in mind a much more extensive integration which would throw tremendous light on the formation of propositions, theory formation, the whole problem of induction. And in fact, she was studying higher mathematics in her final years with someone who is in this audience right now toward working on that. Unfortunately, she only left very fragmentary leads. But that, to me, is the most profitable field to pursue, if someone knows how. In the other direction, I think, is applications. The kind of thing that I did for education, briefly at least, here, has to be done for many other fields, such as philosophy of science and philosophy of math and philosophy of law and philosophy of medicine. There's a tremendous number of areas where the broad principles have to be brought down to the particular area and applied so that men in every field and area know how to translate ASA into their concrete area. And that is the other direction that I see. Did you gain anything of value from university philosophy courses besides a degree? Well, in Canada, I did. I learned a lot of philosophy in Canada in my philosophy courses. It's strictly history of philosophy, what had been taught and why, much less in the United States. I would say it's hard to put in 10 years and gain nothing, but it's minimal relative to the time and the money involved. I learned, you know, something. But did any of your classmates in the 1950s see the value of objectivism? No. That's a simple answer. What is the present state in the development of an Atlas Shrugged motion picture? Nowhere. The present state is like this. In order to make a motion picture, we have to have what's called a package. And a package is a star, a director, and a script. And then you go with that to some studio, and hopefully they say, terrific, let's make a movie. But they can't grasp from a novel what kind of movie it would be. They have to see a script. The scripts are very expensive. We are trying now to raise the money to finance a script by means of a public offering. Unfortunately, thanks to the SEC, it is prohibitive to make such an offering except to millionaires, because the small investor has to be protected against himself in case he should inadvertently invest in something that he would lose money on. So practically speaking, the legal work is too expensive to offer anything less than $50,000 for one individual. And if two individuals who each have $25,000 want to get together, they are legally prohibited from doing so. Consequently, it is very difficult. And there's any number of people that want to invest in this that are prohibited by the government from doing so. So when you have the government against you and all of the studios against you, it's very difficult to do. Gradually, slowly, we're trying to accumulate the capital. Will we do it? I think possibly someday, but I do not know when. The institutional opposition is so tremendous that it's really difficult to get anything. And this is a long question about Ayn Rand's unpublished nonfiction. When are you going to publish it? Well, as soon as we can get it in some kind of shape. For instance, Harry Binswanger, in the last issue of the Forum, started publishing excerpts from her epistemology workshop. We're working on a lot of her nonfiction. There's going to be a book of her lectures on fiction writing that will be come out edited by Harry Binswanger. There's going to be a book of her lectures on nonfiction writing come out that will be edited by Peter Schwartz. It's going to be a book of her philosophic journals. Everything will, the book of her correspondence, a lot of which is heavily philosophical, all of that will come out in the course of time, but we can't do everything at once because there's only 27 hours in every day. By what process and with what timing do you envision the publication of a book presenting objectivism fully? By the process of me writing it, which I am now one-third of the way through, and This is essentially an edited and expanded, reorganized version of my course on the philosophy of objectivism. It will be in the form of 12 lectures, but it's pretty much better, I think, than the course. Same philosophy, but more organized. And it, I would envision, will be finished, given the speed with which I wrote the last book. I hesitate, but it really is going very rapidly. I would think I could finish it in less than 2 years. In which case, then add another year to be published. I would think it should definitely be out within 3 years. This one is a lengthy discussion of why epistemology is important, and then what am I going to do about it? Well, all I can say is, I could give you a list of the books I'm going to do someday if I live that long. But I will just tell you that when I finish the one that I'm on now, on the presentation of objectivism, the next one that I want to work on, which I have some notes, is called Concepts in Human Life. That's its tentative title right now, and it's going to be, in effect, an exploration in greater detail, both extensively and intensively, of the issue of concepts and what important roles they have throughout all the ranges of life, and I find that this is really the key to everything. For instance, this whole course on education is one small example, and I say small because the whole thing of curriculum and teaching methods and everything goes back to that. If you read the early Ayn Rand and you saw my analysis of her style and the part prefacing The Fountainhead, the whole thing was her ability to relate abstractions and concretes, which is concepts within the realm of literary style. And then now make a big jump from those two concretes to the issue of how do you really prove something in philosophy? And why do people have so much difficulty seeing the truth of various philosophic conclusions? Because you have to think in principles, which means conceptually, and that's something that has to be learned. So that what I want to do, I have a tremendous number of ideas and possibilities, is take all the whole breadth and depth of life in effect from that one aspect, from the most abstruse explorations into epistemology on down to literary style and education and law, etc., from one specific point of view. Why, if you know concepts, you can untangle it all, you see? And that to me is what I'm going to be doing, assuming, you know, that time ever came to do it. Now, it is shameless of me to read the next question, especially in as much as I have nothing very much to say in answer, but I just want to thank whoever asked it for wording this question this way. I hope you don't think it's too brazen of me to read this question. How have you developed yourself into such an outstanding teacher? Thank you for the vote of confidence. But I don't really know what I would say. You mean what biographically or what events helped me become a teacher? It's really hard to say much beyond the role of philosophy. I liked teaching from the time I was very young. I repeatedly had in class the experience that the teacher wasn't making the material clear, like, you know, in grade 3 or whatever, and the other kids didn't get it, and it's because she didn't present it correctly. Like, I learned it from her, and then I would reorganize it and give it to the kids. And I got a lot of pleasure from that activity from as far back as I can remember. I also always followed this rule, if it's of any use to you. Whenever I presented something to any class from the earliest on up, I would review it when I went home, just automatically, not as a duty. And if there was any aspect of it which I felt was not really clear, I would try to figure out, well, what should I have said? What was it that wasn't really clear? And that was completely automatic, and that's automatic to this day. If I go home like from a question period, well, by now it's pretty hard because so many of the questions are similar to ones I've already automatized. But if I will automatically almost go over what, were there answers that I wasn't really satisfied with? Are there aspects that I thought would be clear and I could see the class didn't really get it, etc.? And you just consistently try to improve your presentation by the feedback that you get. One of the best ways of becoming a good teacher is to give a set of written exams and read the answers that you get. And if you're like me, you will be absolutely astounded at the misconceptions, at the errors, at the things that you thought were crystal clear, and they were just completely misapprehended. And then you begin to see that you have to make distinctions, and you have to take it slower, and you have to reiterate that you gradually, I think, learn. I think I should give credit also briefly, if credit is the appropriate word, to my parents, with whom I didn't always have a philosophic communion, but I had this much with regard to teaching. My father was a good teacher of medicine. He was a surgeon, but he taught surgery. He was very proud of his teaching ability, and I was very impressed by that. And my mother edited every paper I ever wrote from grade 1 through the end of high school. She never let me hand it in before she went over it in the method that I was telling you the other day. That is, the written work. She attached great importance to wording, and I think I did learn a great deal about the importance of precision. Not, certainly not philosophy from her, but the importance of precision. And then, of course, that made me very right for philosophy. That's a few for what it's worth.